Martin Barron is a longtime journalist and newspaper editor. He ran the newsrooms of the Miami Herald and the Boston Globe before being named executive editor of the Washington Post in 2013. His role in launching an investigation of the Catholic Church's cover-up of sexual abuse by clergy was portrayed in the Academy Award-winning film Spotlight. Barron retired from daily journalism in early 2021. He tells his story in the book Collision of Power, Trump, Bezos, and the Washington Post. Barron will be part of the Spencertown Academy's Festival of Books, celebrating its 19th season this Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. Marty will speak at 3 p.m. on Saturday afternoon, August 31st, SpencertownAcademy.org for more information. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Martin Barron back to the Roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Really nice to speak to you again. The last time we spoke, the book was just out. And what has this been like this past year of talking about it, talking about journalism, and really of how it has been received overall?
It's been great. It's been incredibly busy. I've been struck by how much interest there is in the issues that I address within the book, and as well as the history of what happened at the Washington Post. I've traveled all over the country, and I've traveled overseas speaking about it. In May, it came out in Spanish, and so I was in Spain, did 16 interviews there in 2.5 days, which was extraordinary in terms of the level of interest. So, and it continues. This fall, I'm back on the road. I'll be back overseas. And I've been very pleased with the reception and certainly with the reviews.
What does it tell you about our collective, our relationship with the current state of journalism, specifically print journalism?
Well, I think there's obviously a lot of concern with the state of our democracy. And when we're thinking about the state of our democracy, we're thinking about the state of journalism and the role of journalism within that democracy. And I think certainly before Trump entered the White House in 2017, you know, there was a lot of concern about whether the press would be doing its job or not doing its job, or questions about how the press should do its job. And I think that those that preoccupation really continues till today, as we are in the midst of another presidential election. And then there are a lot of people, certainly within the field of journalism, but also within communities, who are very concerned about the sustainability of their own local news media, particularly their local newspapers. And so they want to know what kind of future it has, or even if it has a future, and also how we can make this transition successfully to a digital future.
And you believe that can be done, that there is a future?
Oh, absolutely. As long as we have a democracy, I think we'll have journalism. I think that, you know, you can't have a successful democracy or a democracy at all without a free and independent press. And you certainly can't have a free and independent press without a democracy. I think as long as we have a democracy where people are called upon to participate in governance, governance of their own communities, their own states, and the country, that there will be a need for accurate, verified information. There will be a need for an organization that keeps watch over local government officials, state government officials, and of course, those at the national level, and all institutions of authority and power. I think the public wants that, expects that, and certainly needs that.
Let's just take an example from this past week where the Washington Post receives, other news organizations as well, but the Washington Post receives a document that appears to be the vetting of J.D. Vance. And as of this recording, those who have received it, the Post, I believe Politico, New York Times, perhaps others, have not done anything with that information. How in your mind is, I assume you think that's the right call, but I also, of what that tells us about where we are right now in receiving information and the trustworthiness of that information, and what onus it puts on journalists to be the gatekeepers of that information.
Sure. Well, these are always difficult decisions. I think that the press has reflected really on its role in 2016 when Democratic National Committee, when Hillary Clinton's emails were hacked by the Russians and were fed to WikiLeaks, which then disseminated it. And so People have reflected on exactly what our policies really ought to be. And in 2020, during the 2020 election, I did issue a policy to our staff at the Washington Post, and that was that while we didn't necessarily forswear publishing information that was contained in hacks, we really needed to pay a lot more attention actually to what was the provenance of those of that information, who did the hacking, what was their motive, all of that. So I think that the current approach by all of these media outlets, the ones that you've mentioned and any others that might possess this information, is that they want to focus on the role that apparently Iran had in hacking and what its motives might be. Clearly, it appears that Iran also tried to hack the Democrats, not only Donald Trump, but and take a look at whether the information that they've received is truly consequential or not. It's not clear to me that the information that they've received, the vetting of J.D. Vance, is all that consequential. From the descriptions of it, it pretty much tells you what we already knew, what the press has already covered about J.D. Vance, that there's really nothing new in there. So I'm not sure that it reveals anything that's terribly consequential that would be at all decisive in how voters decide to exercise their right to vote.
You have, I don't think you'll take offense to this, but you have been around a long time. You've been in many newsrooms. Have you ever seen a news cycle like the last 8 weeks?
Right. Well, I have been around a long time. I don't take offense because it's just a plain fact. But it's actually more than the last 8 weeks. You know, if you go back to what's been happening in the Middle East, for example, this has
Absolutely.
been an incredibly busy time. No, I really, I mean, I've experienced some extraordinarily busy periods, certainly covering the presidential elections of 2016 and 2020. But I mean, I think 2020 was also an incredibly busy year. Of course, remember we had a pandemic that
Right.
affected everybody in every field, every individual throughout the world. So that was huge. Then we had the racial justice protests. And then, of course, we were in the middle of the presidential election and we had the hacks in 2016. And Donald Trump was a candidate who was different from any other candidate we had experienced running for the presidency. That was pretty busy. But certainly, and maybe it was equivalent to what we're experiencing now, but certainly the last 8 weeks plus have been extraordinary in terms of the amount of news that we've received. And the presidential election has taken turns unlike any we've seen in our lifetimes.
Yeah, and I guess that's what I was focusing mostly on of you. You have a race that seems to be set, then you have an assassination attempt. There is a botched debate by the president, and then everything changes, and that pendulum has swung. And do you think that there is a? I mean, it's not the way things are, of course, but we're really getting a distillation of the democratic process of a presidential campaign because we've been forced to, that it's not 2, 3, 4 years in running, that it's very distilled now.
Yeah, sort of makes me hope that we could just distill it in the future down to a few months as opposed to having it last for a few years.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, look, we're extraordinary as a country in that we have presidential campaigns that go on for so long. I think that's exhausting and wearing, and it costs a lot of money, not necessarily money well spent, but it is the money that's spent on these campaigns. Well, I think one of the things that we've learned is that nothing is predictable. I was in Litchfield County in Connecticut some weeks back, and one of the questioners said, "Well, I think we can assume this was before Biden had pulled out of the campaign." And he said, "I think we can assume that it's inevitable that Donald Trump will win the presidency and the Republicans will win both houses of Congress." And I said, "Well, my experience as a journalist over almost half a century was that nothing is inevitable." It turns out that that's the case. The only thing that's inevitable in our world today, and particularly within politics, the only thing that's inevitable is the unpredictable. And we've certainly seen that.
Right. And who knows what the unpredictable is in the next several weeks.
We don't know.
Right.
The wisest and least spoken words in the world of politics, particularly among journalistic pundits, is "I don't know." And I am prone to saying, "I don't know how things are going to turn out."
Do you still get jazzed by it? Do you still get, I mean, there's the this is all haunting, some of it, of as to our democracy and holding on to that. And that aside, which I know is difficult, but just being a journalist and being someone who enjoys the craft is this exciting?
Yeah, you know, it's exciting to watch. I mean, it's intriguing and certainly keeps my interest, that's for sure. at this stage of my life, it's not something I want to be in the middle of because I would be right back to what I was doing before I retired in February of 2021, which was that I was not only working 24/7, I was working 24/7 in every minute, and I'd been doing that for quite a few years, and that was exhausting. And so I was sleep deprived and wiped out. I was ready to step aside, but certainly, I'm engaged intellectually in what's happening today, and I find it fascinating.
I'm interested in given a large part of the book having to do with Jeff Bezos and the ownership of the Washington Post. I'm interested in when I think of just what occurred recently with the interview between Elon Musk and Donald Trump, of what you make of those who have such an incredible platform and are able to, not that those two individuals are at all alike, but what it is like to have that platform and to be able to use it that way, and how we keep that in check.
Yeah, well, I think that's an important question. I think that, this really does highlight the differences between how Elon Musk has used his platform with Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it, and the way that Jeff Bezos has used what he owns, which is the Washington Post. Jeff Bezos never interfered in the news coverage of the Washington Post. He doesn't use it as a platform to express his own views. He doesn't dictate what stories we do. He doesn't suppress stories. He doesn't critique stories. He doesn't do any of that, even when the coverage involves himself or Amazon. That's quite a bit different from the way that Elon Musk has handled himself during his ownership of Twitter. He has enormous power, one of the top social media platforms in the world. He has 190 million plus followers. He often puts his own tweets right at the top of everybody's news feed. Every single person who, whether you've signed up to follow him or not, I have not signed up to follow him, but I still get his posts right there at the top, and whether I want them or not. And then, of course, he's using the platform to engage in politics in a very active, aggressive way. And as some have said, and I would agree with this, the so-called interview, it wasn't really much of an interview or conversation that he had with Donald Trump the other day, was really almost an in-kind contribution to the Trump campaign and worth a lot of money, by the way, that Trump paid nothing for. Elon Musk has endorsed Donald Trump. He endorsed him the day of the assassination attempt, but he was clearly leaning in Trump's direction very heavily in Trump's direction prior to that. And he's capitalized on his property, Twitter, to advance the political cause of Donald Trump.
News outlets such as CNN and MSNBC and others came under a lot of criticism following the 2016 election for giving what you just described as free media to the Trump campaign and putting him front and center. When you're at the helm of the Washington Post at that time, is that something that you were concerned about? What kind of meetings and conversations did you have with your journalists as to the coverage and to keep that the way that you felt it should be?
Well, unlike CNN and Fox and maybe some others, we didn't live stream Trump's rallies around the world, which is what CNN and Fox did during that campaign from beginning to end without any interruption or without any intermediaries. They ran everything that Donald Trump said, true or false, and there was a lot of false in there. So we never did that, and we never saw that as our role. Even though we had the capacity to do that, of course, online, but that's not what we did. We saw our job as trying to find out who Donald Trump really was, looking back at his life, his career, and taking a look at what his policies were, and trying to determine what kind of president he was likely to be. We did so much of that, we went so deep on that, that we actually published a book called Trump Revealed. And I think if somebody were to go back and reread that book, as I did in preparation for my own book, I think they would find it quite revelatory. Anyone who says that we didn't warn the public about what Trump would be like or tell the public what Trump would be like hasn't actually gone back and truly looked at the work that was done. And I think that's the responsibility of the press, is to really take a look, to hold our public officials accountable. Same with Joe Biden, same with Kamala Harris, same with everybody, is really take a look at their record and what their policies would be when they're in office.
So let's look at that accountability. And I agree. I mean, certainly that has been the case. Why does it not stick better with many voters and people and citizenry and that look at this, that have been hearing this information from Donald Trump for 9 years now? And really, I mean, again, jury's still out. We don't know what the latest twists and turns will, where they'll bring us. But still, it's been almost a decade, and it's still going strong.
Sure. Look, people vote for all sorts of reasons. I think that one of the mistakes the press made, including the Washington Post, is that we didn't anticipate a candidate like Donald Trump. We didn't get out into the country enough to really understand the level of grievance and anger and discontent that was out there, and the feeling that people felt they were left out, that they had not participated in economic progress, that there were, and there are a ton of communities, I mean, many, many communities that are really struggling, where people don't have jobs that pay at the levels that they used to, where they don't see opportunities for their kids, where their communities are suffering from all sorts of social ills, and where they feel that these so-called elites, including maybe especially the press, have really not paid attention to them and don't really understand their lives and haven't reflected their lives and their coverage. And so in many ways, the election of Donald Trump was an effort to punch the elites in the face. And that's still a driving force, I think, behind Donald Trump, is a desire to, you know, sort of confront the elites, to punch us in the face, the so-called elites, and blow things up, basically be an arsonist, tear things down. And so, you know, people vote for a lot of different reasons, and they're not always the things that the press tends to take a look at. So, you know, over the course of Trump's administration, you know, the Washington Post, its fact checker, documented over 30,000 lies, falsehoods, misleading statements, and that's all documented. But the public, not all of the public really cares about that. They care whether his policies are the ones that they agree with, or whether he seems to speak to them and for them. And they see his enemies as their enemies. They want to put people in their place. And so people vote for all sorts of reasons that have, you know, are not necessarily from the perspective of journalists.
Did it surprise you? Did it surprise the staff of the newspaper at the time as you were reporting, as you said, over 30,000 falsehoods, that people did not seem alarmed by that? In the sense, I mean, certain people did, of course, are alarmed. They're still alarmed. And I'm not saying there wasn't alarm. But that, in the hands of many other political figures, would have sunk the battleship. And that did not happen in this case.
Right. Well, the political environment's different today than it was in the past. I mean, look, I mean, the reality is the polls show that if you know, that the American public does not give Donald Trump high ratings for trustworthiness, for being truthful. They actually is well less than 50% for him, who believe that he is generally truthful. And it's a very poor rating for him. And he never achieved more than a 50% approval rating during his entire administration. That said, I wasn't surprised that it didn't have the impact that, you know, you suggest. Because I felt it was our duty to document that what he was saying was not true. But did I necessarily feel that people would vote according to that? Some people would, but a lot of people wouldn't. They were voting on whether they agreed with his policy on taxes, or they agreed with his policy on immigration, you know, whether they felt that he was going to address the concerns of people like themselves. And they didn't really care whether he was being truthful. And in fact, that was part of the show, and they were enjoying the show, and they didn't really hold him to the same standard that is suggested by your question.
Is there a weariness that comes when the former president says, okay, well, at the Kamala Harris rally, nobody was there at the airport. If those 15,000 people weren't there, do you feel that even the absurdity of that, that as journalists and as a newspaper, it's still your responsibility to tap us on the shoulder and say, well, yeah, there were 15,000 people there?
Well, I think we do have to tell people what the facts are. Trump is, I mean, he misleads and lies so consistently that it's more than a full-time job to keep track of that. We at the Post had the fact checker team. We had increased it to 3 people, and I can tell you we could have used double that amount. it was just almost impossible to keep up with it. It's not always clear. I mean, he's li sometimes he lies. Sometimes he doesn't really care what the truth is or not. He just says whatever serves his interests at the time. That's the way it is. But I look. I mean, that claim about nobody being at the to receive Kamala Harris when she came off the plane is just totally false. I mean, that was recorded live by television networks. That was a
Right.
live stream by all sorts of sites. There were photographers there. There were cameramen, there. There were all sorts of people there who can attest to that. It's an outrageous claim. You can't just, even with generative AI, you can't just immediately summon up images of massive crowds. That's not possible. It's ridiculous. And frankly, I don't even think that his fans believe that. They just don't. Do they care whether he just made that up or not? That's another matter. For them, that's fine if he says that. But I think if you were to poll Trump followers, whether they really believe that those crowd images were generated by artificial intelligence, they would say no.
You will be part of the Spencertown Academy's Festival of Books on the 31st of August at 3 p.m. And I assume you enjoy these events.
I do. I like talking about it. I like, well, it's my community as well, generally. And I live not that far away. And I like talking about journalism, about our role in a democracy, and about the issues that we need to confront within journalism itself. That's what I endeavor to do in this book, Collision of Power. And it's what I do enjoy getting around and talking about it.
The name of the new book is Collision of Power, Trump, Bezos, and the Washington Post. And Marty Baron will be part of the Spencertown Academy's Festival of Books, celebrating its 19th season this Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. And Marty will be speaking at 3 p.m. on Saturday afternoon, the 31st. SpencertownAcademy.org for more information. Thank you so much, sir, for your time. As always, it's wonderful to chat with you, and I thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it.
Take
Take
care.
care.
Marty Baron will speak at 3 p.m. on Saturday afternoon, August 31st. SpencertownAcademy.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.